Let's turn to page 4 on your outline. You continue your Bibles to the book of Daniel, chapter 1. We'll try to finish up our series on the call of the prophets with looking at two prophets today, Daniel for the first half of our study and then Hosea for the second half. Begin to summarize, in the case of Moses, he did not want the job. He gave 5 arguments why he should not be given the job. But once he accepted the office, he carried out rather consistently. Isaiah, on the other hand, was quite anxious to be a prophet and volunteered himself for the office even before he knew what his message was going to be. And with the call, he, again, similar to Moses, just carried out his task, no emotions about his function. The case of Jeremiah, he also was someone who didn't want the job, provided a few less arguments than Moses did. And even after accepting the office, he constantly wrestled over the issue of being a prophet. He complained, he argued with God over these issues. He never was a happy prophet per se. In Ezekiel, we noted he received a special divine vision prior to his call, and then he wrestled with the question whether he should be a prophet for 7 days. After 7 days, he finally accepted it and then, again, simply carried out his mission. And so now we come to Daniel. The name Daniel means God is my judge. God is my judge. Ezekiel mentions him twice in his own book in chapter 14 and chapter 26, 14 and 26, because by the time Ezekiel receives his call to be a prophet, Daniel has been in high position in the Babylonian government for about 15, 16 years. Now, if you look at the Hebrew Bible, for example, you will notice that Daniel is not fit in the same place where you have the English Bible. The English Bible is arranged where all the prophets coming at the end. Daniel is among the prophetic section. In fact, he's one of the 4 major prophets, followed by 12 minor ones. In the Hebrew Bible, divided between the law, the prophets, and the writings, Daniel is found in the 3rd category, the writings, and not in the prophetic section. And probably this was because officially Daniel was a statesman, not a prophet. But that says nothing about the authorship, nothing about the date per se. Let me repeat something I mentioned yesterday in connection with Ezekiel. There were 3 deportations of Jews from Judea into Babylonia. It was mentioned that Ezekiel was taken the 2nd deportation in the year 597 BC, but Daniel and his 3 friends went the 1st deportation in 605 BC. So again, Daniel was placed by God in high position of authority before the remaining captives came. Now, the style of the book he writes is usually referred to as apocalyptic. And in fact, the Greek name for the last book of the Bible, the New Testament, Revelation, is the Apocalypse. And Daniel is also similar to Revelation. It's an apocalyptic book. And the characteristics of an apocalyptic book include the fact that it contains supernatural visions and symbolic visions. A lot of symbols are used. Furthermore, it's often written during a time of oppression, which was the case for both Revelation and Daniel. As the prophet receives these various visions, he does not always understand what he sees, and there is an interpreting angel explaining to him the meaning of these visions that he sees. In the Old Testament, we have 3 books that are apocalyptic like this, Daniel, Zechariah, also Ezekiel to a lesser extent. Ezekiel, Daniel, Zechariah. New Testament, we have only one, the book of Revelation. What's unique about this book is it's written in two different languages. Part of the book is written in Hebrew, chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 3. Chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 3 is Hebrew. So are chapters 8 through 12. 8 through 12 are Hebrew. But in between the two Hebrew portions, you have the book written in Aramaic, which was the tongue of the Babylonians, from chapter 2, verse 4, to the end of chapter 7. Chapter 2, verse 4, to the end of chapter 7. So primary two languages here is Hebrew and Aramaic. However, he also has 21 Persian words. In the latter part where the Persians take over, but also three Greek words, and all three Greek words refer to musical instruments. And like Jeremiah, he didn't put his book together in chronological sequence. We can easily rearrange his book chronologically because of the dates he provides for us. He put the book together thematically rather than chronologically. As far as the purpose of his book, basically the purpose of this book is to explain how Jews should live in a Gentile world. How should Jews live in a Gentile world, especially when the law of Moses was still the rule of life? So certain ways he could and would live with the land of Israel as a loyal Jew to Mosaic law, but now he's away from the land, he's away from the city, he's away from the temple. The temple was still standing when he became a captive. How should he now live in light of that? So again, the book teaches Jewish people in exile how they should live under the law of Moses in exile. A second purpose of the book is to teach Gentiles the nature of Israel's God. Because keep in mind, by normal pagan theology, Jehovah, the God of Israel, was a defeated God. Because in the theology of ancient times, when two armies were fighting here on earth, the gods of these armies were fighting up in the heavens. Whichever gods win up here, their armies would win down here. And for that reason, a conquering king would take the idols of the defeated nation and transport those idols to his own homeland. And so by normal pagan standards, Jehovah was a defeated God because Babylon defeated Judah. And now these pagans will have to learn the nature of Israel's God. In the book of Daniel, have pagan kings recognizing the superiority of this God. They never come to a point of recognizing him to be the only God. They don't come to real salvation. They just simply recognize, number one, that the God of Judah can be part of the pantheon, and he is a superior God, but not the only God. Now, third purpose for the book is to look out for the welfare of the Jewish people in Babylonian captivity, because Daniel will be a leader in the government for the whole duration of captivity, the whole 70-year period he will be there. And the fourth purpose is to continue a principle already begun in the account of Elijah the prophet, the principle of the remnant. And again, there is all Israel, all Jews, all who are descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Within a larger Israel is a small Israel called the remnant of Israel. And these are Jews who actually believed what God had revealed through Moses and the prophets. And Daniel and his three friends are members of the remnant. But the theme of the book, well, these are four purposes we can mention. The theme of the book is the times of the Gentiles. The times of the Gentiles. He will portray how the Gentile world empires will number four and the stages it will go through before the kingdom of God replaces them. Now, the book of Daniel can be divided in different ways. Some people choose to divide it based upon content and see two parts. Chapters 1 through 6 is primarily historical, with some prophecy, and chapter 7 to 12 is primarily prophetic with some history. A second way people have divided the book is based upon language, since they have three divisions, Hebrew, Aramaic, back to Hebrew. And a third way, which is my own preferred way, and they're all valid, is to simply go by various topics. Every chapter is its own topic for the first nine chapters, then chapters 10 through 12 form one unit. Our focus is the nature by which he came into his prophetic office, and that brings us to chapter 1. Capital A, the historical background in chapter 1, verses 1 through 7, and point 1, the deportation in chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. The deportation described here is again the first deportation of 605 BC, and the siege is described in verse 1, and he dates it as the third year of Jehoiakim. That would appear to contradict what Jeremiah wrote, because Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 1, Jeremiah 25, 1, told us it was the fourth year of Jehoiakim. There's no contradiction, because Daniel now is using Babylonian reckoning of time, which begins with the first full year a king reigns, and does not count the year of succession, whereas Jeremiah was using Jewish time, where part of a year counts for the whole year. So in Jewish reckoning, it is the fourth year, whereas in Daniel's reckoning, it is the third year. Either way, it ends up being 605 BC. And we're told King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, is responsible for destroying the city and causing the captivity to begin. And this year, 605, marks the beginning of Jeremiah's prophecy about 70 years of captivity. It'll go from 605 till 536 BC, and those are your 70 years. And already given by the prophets was the reason for the captivity, two main reasons. One major reason is idolatry. In Jeremiah 44, verses 20 through 23, Jeremiah 44, 20 to 23. And so what God does is take them into captivity, into the center of world idolatry. This is the city where idolatry began in Genesis 11, verses 1 through 9. Keeping in mind Babel and Babylon are the same thing. That's where idolatry began. So he brought Israel right into the center of idolatry, where they would get so much of it, they'll get sick of it. Except for rare occasions, so idolatry ceased being a Jewish problem when they returned from Babylonia. And a second reason why the captivity came is because of their violations of the sabbatical year, and they failed to fulfill the sabbatical year. And they counted how many years were not practiced, altogether 70. And so the captivity would be 70 years, so land could make up its lost sabbatical years. This is 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 21. 2 Chronicles 36, 21. And verse 2 says, describes the fall. Jehoiakim was given to the hands of the Babylonians. And verse 2 says, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim. And in Hebrew, by the way, the word Lord here is used in the plural form. In the book of Daniel, the primary way Daniel referred to God is simply by the term Lord. He does not use God's name except in one chapter, and that'll be in chapter 9 is the only place he will use God's name. But the fact he uses the word Lord here in the plural again opens the door for a plurality in the Godhead. But the emphasis of verse 2 is that it's God who turned his own people over to Nebuchadnezzar. And so it's not that the gods of Babylon had beaten the God of Judah. The God of Judah simply turned his own people over to Babylonia for captivity and punishment. So in spite of what Nebuchadnezzar might feel his God was, the leader of the heavens and earth, that's actually only true of the God of Israel. He also mentions that part of the vessels of the temple were given over to Nebuchadnezzar. Later, there'll be a more despoiling of the temple in the second deportation, and further more despoiling in the third deportation. Now, keep in mind what I mentioned earlier, that in pagan theology, the god of the victor nation is the god who conquered the gods of the defeated nation. And again, they would take the images of the defeated gods into captivity, but there was no image of the God of Israel in the Jewish temple. There was nothing there, no image to take and bring it to Babylon. So in place of taking image of the God of Israel into the Babylonian temple, all he can do is take holy vessels into captivity. And what Nebuchadnezzar does not realize when he does this here in verse 2 is that by taking these vessels to Babylonia, he's planting the seeds of Babylon's fall. And in chapter 5, when his grandson Belshazzar begins to drink from these vessels in the honor and worship of Babylonian gods, there'll be the writing on the wall decreeing Babylon's fall. It says they're taking the land of Shinar. Shinar is the name of the country, and Babylon is the city within the land of Shinar. And again, it was always the center of idolatry. And in Genesis chapter 10, verses 8 through 12, Genesis 10, 8 through 12, this is where Nimrod began to build his first empire. It's when Nimrod first built Babylon, then he went to build Nineveh. And one more thing in verse 2 is that the King Nebuchadnezzar brings these vessels into the treasure house of his god. His god was called Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K, M-A-R-D-U-K. Now, point 2, we have the selection of the royal children for training in chapter 1, verses 3 through 7, and the selection is given in verse 3 and 4. And the choosing is done by one in particular, Ashpenaz, the master of eunuchs. And while sometimes the word eunuch here could mean merely a high official, as it does in Genesis chapter 37, verse 36, Genesis 37, 36, in most cases, it refers to someone who was castrated. And this was often done with people that were taken into captivity to be used to serve in the new government, and the castration was so the duties could be performed without any interference of marriage. So all those selected would also suffer castration, which would include Daniel and his three friends. So you read nothing about the wife of Daniel, for example. And the castration of the royal seed thus fulfill a specific prophecy made in Isaiah chapter 39, verse 7. Isaiah 39, verse 7, where members of the royal house would be castrated by the Babylonians. And there are certain limitations of those to be selected. They had to be of the seed royal, and the seed royal means that they were members of the house of David. And that indicates at least Daniel, perhaps his three friends as well, but minimally at least Daniel, was a member of the house of David. He was not of the royal line, not of the kingly line, but he was a descendant of one of David's other sons that was not of the kingly line. And because they are castrated, that's why they're placed under the authority of the master of the eunuchs. And the second category mentions the noble class. And because the three friends are distinguished from Daniel throughout the book, most likely Daniel was of the royal house, while the three friends were of the nobility. And also in verse 3, calls the children of Israel, because with the fall of Judah, the names Judah and Israel now become used interchangeably. So even the southern kingdom is once again referred to as Israel. And verse 4 provides us with the qualifications. First of all, they had to be youths, probably somewhere between the ages of 15 and 20. As to the physical qualities, they had to have no blemish, meaning no physical defect, and well-favored, meaning they were pleasant in appearance. As far as mental qualities, they had to be skillful in wisdom, they had to have a good learning capability, an ability to make distinctions and proper decisions. He also mentions endued with knowledge, individual bits of knowledge. It points to someone who has a quick mind. And then he mentions understanding science. Science refers to systematic bodies of knowledge. So he has the power to comprehend a systematic system and be able to assimilate it. And the purpose for this selection, the end of verse 4, to stand in the king's palace, to stand in the king's palace. And the word to stand means to be given an official position. To be an official position, the government, which in this case would mean they become the liaison between the government and the Jews. Daniel's three friends would become liaisons between the government and the Jews in captivity. They would be essentially administrators of Jewish affairs. Now verse 4 goes on to say, to teach them the learning of Babylon. That included the sciences of that day, when Babylon also included all areas of the occult. As a result, Daniel's three friends would be required to learn the principles of occultism as practiced by the Babylonians. But what the text makes clear, none of them ever practice it. They learn about it, as would be required, but being loyal Jews to the Lord, they do not practice it. And also they were to learn the tongue of the Chaldeans. And again, the tongue of the Chaldeans is Aramaic, something Daniel learned real well. He wrote 6 chapters of his book in that language. Now, verse 5, we come to the daily rations. The food included, number 1, a portion of the king's dainties, which simply means whatever the king had for dinner that day, that's what they would have. They would eat the same thing the king would eat. And secondly, also of the royal wine. Duration was to be 3 years, so this marks the duration of training. It would be a 3-year learning process. And the goal was at the end of 3 years, they would stand before the king, and then they would receive their position in the government if they so passed the tests. Now, verses 6 and 7 provide us with their names, which were Hebrew and changed to Babylonian names. And in verse 6, 4 people are selected. Daniel, which means God is my judge. God is my judge. Hananiah, which means Jehovah is gracious. Jehovah is gracious. Mishael. Mishael means who is like God. Who is like God. And Azariah. Azariah means Jehovah helps. Jehovah helps. Now, 2 of the names are based upon the Hebrew word Elohim, which means God, and 2 names are based upon God's name, the short form YAH instead of the full YHVH, simply YH. And this will indicate that these were products of a godly home, and these were people that were not guilty of the sin that brought on the captivity. They were not guilty of the idolatry practiced by the majority population. In verse 7, we see how the names are changed. For Daniel, his name is now Belteshazzar. Belteshazzar, which means may Bel protect his life. May Bel, B-E-L, and the Babylonian god, protect his life. For Hananiah, his name is changed to Shadrach, and Shadrach means the command of Aku, A-K-U, another Babylonian god, command of Aku. Aku was the sun god. For Mishael, his name is changed to Meshach, which means basically, what is comparable to Shaiku? What is comparable to Shaiku, S-H-A-I-K-U, Shaikum, the Babylonian name for Venus. And the last name Azariah is changed to Evednego, meaning the servant of Nebo. The servant of Nebo. Nebo, N-E-B-O, is another name for Babylonian gods. Now, some observations here. First of all, the names are given to these four men by the prince of eunuchs. However, the names were actually chosen by Nebuchadnezzar. This comes out in chapter 4, verse 8, chapter 4, verse 8, and again in chapter 5, verse 12, chapter 5, verse 12. Now, why would Nebuchadnezzar care? Well, as a principle in ancient times that the Bible also portrays, the power to name is to exercise authority over it. The power to name something exercises authority over it. So, for example, God named Adam, but Adam named Eve. God had authority of Adam, Adam over authority of Eve. And because God gave the animal kingdom to the authority of man, Adam names the animal kingdom. You often find when the Bible, when one king conquers another, as when the Egyptian king conquered Judah, he changed the names of the kings. And so one main reason why he would change the names is to show he's got authority over these men. But there might be more to it. It might also be due to the fact that the original Hebrew names were connected with the true God and might bring about some conviction. Otherwise, why does he care? Now, what we know from Jeremiah is this. Nebuchadnezzar did have a knowledge of the true God, and he knew about the predictions of Jeremiah concerning the fall of Jerusalem. He knew that in advance of it happening. We see this in Jeremiah 39, verses 11 through 14. Jeremiah 39, 11 through 14. Also chapter 40, verses 1 through 6. Chapter 40, verses 1 through 6. And because he heard about the prophecy before taking Jerusalem, that took away some of the glory of the spoil. Because how could he go around claiming his God defeated the God of Judah when he knew in advance that a prophet of the God of Judah was predicting Judah would fall? And so perhaps to avoid any connection with the God of Israel, he chose to change their names. What's interesting is this. Among Jewish people, these men always retain a better known by their Hebrew names. In Jewish writings, they're always called by the Hebrew names, but among Christians, they're better known by their pagan names. That's the way history has developed. So most people that have been Christians for a while, they can name the Babylonian names for the three friends, but they can't name the Hebrew names. Daniel, fortunately, maintained his Hebrew name among Christians. Now, capital B, the testing of Daniel and his friends in chapter 1, verses 8 through 16, and point 1, the request of the prince of eunuchs in chapter 1, verses 8 through 10. In verse 8, Daniel makes a commitment not to defile himself with the two elements given to him for food. First of all, the king's dainties. So why not? Because certain meats might not be kosher in accordance with the Mosaic law. Or certain meats might be kosher but would not have been killed in the proper way. And furthermore, it might be mixed with fat and blood, and those two parts of the animal were forbidden for Jews to eat. As for the wine, wine was not forbidden by the Mosaic law, but it was part of the sacrificial system to idols, and wine was used to worship the Babylonian gods, as we see in chapter 5, verses 1 through 3. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 3. Therefore, for a Jew under the law, to partake of these things would be defiling. And so his request in verse 8 of the prince of eunuchs is not to defile himself. And Ashpenaz's answer is given in verses 9 and 10. And verse 9 shows that Daniel had a good standing before Ashpenaz. And Ashpenaz showed him kindness and compassion. However, Ashpenaz refuses the request. And the reason is Ashpenaz answers directly to the king. And therefore, there will be a fear factor. Because if Ashpenaz allowed Dan's three friends to follow this other diet, and they look worse for wear, that would mean the execution of Ashpenaz. And therefore, to save his own life, as much as he liked Daniel, he would not grant the offer. So point two, we have the request of the steward in chapter 1, verses 11 through 16. Now the steward in verse 11 was working under Ashpenaz. And the steward answered to Ashpenaz and not to the king, and therefore might be more willing to give the request. A request is kept minimally in verse 12 and 13, and they asked the steward just to give them a 10-day test. Give us only pulse to eat. And what pulse means is food that grows out of the ground, food that grows from sown seed. That includes both vegetables and grain. And under the Mosaic law, there was no unclean vegetables, no unkosher vegetables. So as far as food, give us food only that which grows up out of the ground, and give us only water to drink, then compare us with the other people in the training school and make a final decision. And in verse 14, the steward agrees. And in verse 15 and 16, we see the results. Verse 15 says they were better than the others in two ways. First of all, they were fairer in appearance. And secondly, they were fatter in the flesh. Now keep in mind, they became strict vegetarians here. And normally vegetarians who follow the rules strictly don't get fat, they get thin. The opposite happened here because of divine intervention. The lesson here is not, as some take it to mean, that vegetables are better than meat. That's not the lesson. It's not teaching vegetarianism. What's teaching is obedience is better than disobedience. Obedience is better than disobedience. And to partake of the kind of meat they were offered would be disobedience. As a result of this, in verse 16, they'll have to continue the vegetarian diet. So come to capital C, the blessing of Daniel in chapter 1, verses 17 through 21. In verse 17, we have development of all four men. All four develop knowledge and skill in learning and wisdom. But something special for Daniel. Daniel was given understanding in all visions and dreams, and that phrase sets the stage for the whole book. And that's why he takes prominence over the others. God gives him a special understanding of visions and dreams. And because of this special understanding, he'll be brought into the prophetic office. He does not receive any special call, as we've seen with the others. He's simply given certain abilities. And by the use of these abilities, he's able to transfer into the office of a prophet. Now, in verses 18 to 20, we have the appointment to the king's office. In verse 18, after 3 years of training, they're presented before King Nebuchadnezzar. And in verse 19, notice the appointment. Okay, I may afterwards. In verse 19, the king... My translation reads communed with them. It's probably an old English form, but it means to be tested. And so I sometimes tell my students in classes or schools where I do some adjunct teaching that after the lecture the next day we're going to have communion. That means they're going to get a test. And these were found to be superior to all the others, and therefore they stood before the king, they're appointed to the office. And verse 20 points out that a tenfold superiority, they're even superior to the native Babylonian magicians and enchanters. And again, all this sets the stage for Daniel's career. And verse 21 says the duration of his career was into the first year of King Cyrus. Now, that's not really where he ended his career, because we're told he prophesied up to the third year of Cyrus in chapter 10, verse 1. 10, verse 1, the mention of the first year simply means that he was there for the whole 70-year captivity period. He'll be there for the whole 70 years. In the case of Daniel, he was simply a Jewish person who was, when contrary to the majority of his day, he simply followed the Mosaic law, taken to captivity because of God's judgment upon Judah. As a result of his abilities and special things God gave him, he simply grew into the prophetic office. And it begins in chapter 2, actually, when he interprets the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. All right, let's now turn to the last of our examples. And we'll now turn to the book of Hosea. First minor prophet. In fact, it's right after Daniel, not chronologically, but just in the book order. Now, Hosea in Hebrew is Hoshea, actually, and it means salvation. It comes from the same root as some other names you're familiar with, same root as Joshua, Isaiah, and even Jesus. Same Hebrew root. We don't have much of a biography with him, except for his situation with his wife. And verse 1 describes the Judean kings that he prophesied under, and also points out the main Israelite king he prophesied under, Jeroboam II. And so the period to which he prophesied was from roughly 752 to 724, 752 to 724, a sizable amount of time. He comes after Amos. And Amos was a prophet from Judah that came north to Israel, prophesying the Assyrian captivity. Hosea is a prophet from the north and to the north. His two contemporaries, Micah and Isaiah, were prophets of Judah. So of all the writing prophets we have, only Hosea is the only prophet that is from the north and was a prophet to the north. The only prophet, writing prophet, who was from the north and to the north. Elijah and Elisha were prophets of the north, but they were not writing prophets. So the only writing prophet for Israel is Hosea. Amos was from the south and was sent to the north, and Jonah was from the north, but he was sent to Nineveh. So throughout his book, which is 14 chapters, he speaks primarily to northern kingdom, though he makes 15 references to Judah. In the historical background, the Assyrian Empire was beginning to rise. It was a time of outward prosperity. Look at verse 1 again, you'll see the name Uzziah, who was king of Judah, and then Jeroboam, who was king of Israel. Uzziah and Jeroboam were contemporary kings. Both of them extended their kingdom, so if you put the two Jewish kingdoms together, they had as much territory as David and Solomon. It was not under one government anymore, but the amount of Jewish control was the same as David and Solomon. And the religious pictures, there was the worship of the Canaanite god Baal. There was a continuation of the worship of the golden calf, which was a pseudo-Jehovah worship. Idolatry was widespread. Immorality was widespread. Just within his own book, he mentions murder, bloodshed, adultery, oppression, idolatry, pride. So essentially, he's a prophet sent to a doomed nation. And the key point he makes is that Israel has a lack of knowledge, and because they have a lack of knowledge, they will perish. The lack of knowledge was by their own choice. The knowledge was available. It wasn't lost. It wasn't hidden. The knowledge was available, but it was not being obedient. And the theme of the book is God's love for Israel. In spite of Israel's sinful state, God loves Israel still. And there's two main parts to the book. The first part is what we're going to focus on. The first part is chapters 1 through 3, chapters 1 through 3, which deals with the call of Hosea and how his married life will picture the relationship of God and Israel. Then chapters 4 through 14 is the second part of the book, which deals with all prophetic and picks up some of the themes of the first three chapters and spells them out in more detail, chapters 4 through 14. Now, chapters 4 through 13 is all judgment, all negative. Only in chapter 14 does he move towards a positive element, prophesying Israel's restoration. All right, let's look at the first three chapters. Some things I'll detail, but some things I'll summarize. Now, capital A on your outline, the first commission to Hosea in chapter 1, verse 2 through chapter 2, verse 1. Point 1, the wife and the children in chapter 1, verses 2 through 9. And in verse 2, in the first part of verse 3, it says, when Jehovah spoke at first by Hosea, and the point is that what he's about to describe shows the beginning of his prophetic ministry. And God tells Hosea, go marry a wife of whoredom. He's told to marry a prostitute. Now, the Mosaic law, only a Levite was forbidden to marry a prostitute, so it does not violate the Mosaic law, which God would not ask him to do. This is Leviticus 21, verses 7 and 14. Leviticus 21, 7 through 14. Only Levites were forbidden to marry prostitutes. Because to marry a prostitute, a woman that's been a prostitute, and also take her children before them, adopt the children, they're already born as a result of prostitution. Immediately God gives him the application in verse 2, for the land does commit great whoredom. And so his marriage concerns what is true of the land, because Israel is the wife of Jehovah, don't forget. And just as Hosea's wife will prove to be unfaithful, so has God's wife, Israel, proven to be unfaithful. And so the wife represents the nation as a whole, and the children are individual members of the nation. And the means by which they committed adultery is by means of departing from the Lord. And Hosea obeys, he says, so he went into Gomer, the son of Diblaim. Gomer means perfection or completion. Perfection or completion. Diblaim means double fig cakes, which in ancient times the fig cake was an erotic symbol. You put the two names together, he's referred to as a perfect daughter of pleasure, a perfect daughter of pleasure. And in verses 3 through 9, they have children of their own. The first child, verses 3 through 5, is the child they call Jezreel. And Jezreel has a double meaning, and both meanings will come into play. The name Jezreel could mean either God scatters or God sows. God scatters and God sows. And they'll first experience God scattering them, later God sowing them. And the application is, for yet a little while I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu. Jehu began a brand new dynasty in Israel, and Jehu destroyed the entire house of Ahab. Now, this was by divine decree, but the motivation was improper. What Jehu should have done is destroy the house of Ahab because it was God's will and go back to the true faith. But Jehu's motivation was not to fulfill God's will, but to establish his own power in the kingdom. And he did not reestablish Jehovah worship. He simply did away with Baal worship, but he simply went back to the worship of the golden calf. You'll find this in 2 Kings chapters 9 and 10. 2 Kings chapters 9 and 10. And he says, I will cause the kingdom of the house of Israel to cease in the year 722, 721. Israel will cease to be a nation and go into Assyrian captivity. And the judgment is, I shall come to pass to break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. To break the bow means to break up the kingdom. And the place of the breakup will be in the valley of Jezreel. By the way, this valley is known by Christians as the Valley of Armageddon. That's a Christian name for it. It's not a biblical name for it, but it's a Christian name for it. But the name of the biblical valley is the Valley of Jezreel. At the west end of the Valley of Jezreel is the former city of Armageddon, Megiddo. And the result is Jezreel, they'll be scattered out of the land. The fulfillment is found in 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 29, 2 Kings 15, 29. In verse 6 and 7, they have a second child, this time a daughter. And God decrees him to name the daughter Lo Ruhamah, meaning no mercy. No mercy. And by way of application, Israel will now have no further mercy from the Lord, that the Assyrian captivity is now inevitable in light of Amos' prophecy previously. But for now, there's the exception for Judah in verse 7. I will have mercy upon the house of Judah. Judah was much more faithful than Israel was, and therefore Judah will be spared the Assyrian destruction. For now, Israel has reached the point of no return. Judah has not yet reached the point of no return. So keep in mind, as I mentioned earlier with Jeremiah, Jeremiah would later become the bill of divorcement for Judah, but the book of Hosea becomes the bill of divorcement for Israel. And God is still speaking. We come to verse 7 where he says, I will save them by Jehovah their God. And there are two Jehovahs here, notice. Again, opening the door to a plurality in the Godhead. Jehovah the speaker, and the speaker will save Israel by means of Jehovah. And so when God saves Judah, I should say, it'll be done by the Lord. And indeed, it won't be Judah's army that will stop the Assyrians. It'll be the angel of Jehovah that will do so. In verses 8 and 9, they have a third child. This third child is to be named, is also a son, to be named Lo Ami, meaning not my people. Because while covenantally Israel is always the people of God, experientially they do not experience the blessings of being the people of God when they are in disobedience. And so for a long time Israel will not be God's people experientially. But covenantally they always are the people of God according to Romans 11 verse 1. Romans 11 verse 1. Now point 2 in your outline, we have the future reversal and restoration in chapter 1 verse 10 through chapter 2 verse 1. In a future time there will be a reversal. And that will include in verse 10 national increase, and then they'll experience the other meaning of Jezreel. God sows, and they'll be sown back into the land. And in verse 10, there'll also be a national conversion. Some place of law, me, not my people, they'll become a me, my people. Furthermore, in verse 11, there'll be a national reunification. In the future time, Jew and Israel will become one nation again, not two. Furthermore, in the end of verse 11, there'll be a national leadership. They'll have one leader. And he'll name that leader a bit later in chapter 3. In chapter 2, verse 1, there'll be a national restoration. They'll be called Amim, my people. They'll be called Ruhamah, those who obtain mercy. The cap will be the application to Israel as the wife of Jehovah in chapter 2, verses 2 through 23. Now, chapter 2, verses 2 through 5, describes Israel's adultery. And again, the means of committing adultery was always by means of idolatry. And this adultery in verse 2 resulted in separation. It resulted in being put away, a phrase that means to be divorced. And that led to the two results he mentioned in chapter 1. In verse 3, they became lo ami, not my people. This was seen by the stripping of the land. The land was stripped because of a drought. The stripping was also done to a prostitute, more often to an adulteress. The second result in verse 4 and 5 is lo ruchama, meaning no mercy. And so there was the stripping of the land in general, there's also no mercy upon the individuals, because there had been more children produced when she was in prostitution than when she was still married. And in verse 5, notice the way of committing a spiritual adultery was by means of idolatry. And she was so self-deceived, she felt that all of these good things she had, bread, water, wool, flax, oil, drink, were coming from these other gods, forgetting they were coming really from her own husband. So in verses 6 to 8, he describes the future hedging of Israel. He will build a hedge around her, not for the purpose of protecting her within, for the purpose of keeping her within so she could not get out. And the purpose is to show her that she will be unsuccessful in trying to find these other gods. And in verse 7, she will not find her other lovers. These other gods will prove to be non-entities. And then she will finally see her need to return to her first husband. He quotes her saying, I will go and return to my first husband, the reason, for then was it better with me than now. And verse 8 points out, she failed to recognize that when she received all of the physical benefits of being the wife of Jehovah, she failed to recognize it was Jehovah that gave her the grain, new wine, oil, and multiplied her with the silver and gold. And instead, she took these good things given to her by her true husband and used them to worship Baal. So verses 9 through 13 again describes the stripping of Israel. Again, the stripping in the human realm was the stripping of an adulteress. Israel is now viewed to be an adulterous wife, and therefore she is stripped. In verse 9, she is stripped of food and clothing. In verse 10, she becomes naked. In verses 11 and 12, there is a cessation of mirth and gladness. There is the removal of all security. And in verse 13, she suffers the judgment of the Baalim. The Baalim are the Baal gods she worshipped. She worshipped Baal and burned incense, giving Baal her earrings and her jewels. And he says at the end of verse 13, and forgot me, says Jehovah. When people forget the God they worship, they begin to fall into different forms of idolatry, and that was certainly true with Israel here. However, after a period of judgment, as we come to verses 14 through 23, 14 to 23, we have the restoration of the wife put in rather tender terms. In verse 14 and 15, God will drive them into the wilderness, the desert, and there it says he will speak comfortably to her. The Hebrew is more intimate. It says, I will speak to her heart. I will speak to her heart. And God will again woo his wife in the wilderness. And this will respond positively. In verse 15, I will give her vineyards from thence and the valley of Achor for a door of hope. The valley of Achor means the valley of troubling. The Valley of Troubling was called that as a result of Achan's sin in Joshua chapter 7. Joshua chapter 7, verses 24 to 26. 24 to 26. But now this Valley of Troubling will become a door of new victory and conquest. And it will become a door of hope as Israel comes back to the Lord. And he says in verse 15, she shall make answer there. She will respond to God's courtship, to God's wooing. And that will lead to several results. The first result in verse 17 is a change in Hebrew vocabulary to show removal of idolatry. So he says in verse 16, you will call me Ishi, no longer call me Baalim. Now both Ishi and Baalim are Hebrew terms for my husband. Both Ishi and Baalim are equal terms for my husband. They simply carry a slightly different shade of meaning. Ishi means my husband, the sense of my man. My husband, the sense of my man. And Baalim means my husband, the sense of my master. My husband, the sense of my master. And Baal is a good term, and in modern Hebrew, that's the primary term that is used. It's used legitimately several times in the Bible, as in Genesis chapter 20, verse 3, Genesis 20, verse 3, among other places. The problem here is that while the word Baal is a legitimate Hebrew word meaning my husband, it sounds too much like the name of that god she committed adultery with, the god Baal, Baal. As a result, in the Messianic kingdom, after Israel's national salvation, Baal will be dropped from the Hebrew vocabulary that used only Ishi, my husband, a sense of my man. So in verse 17, all remembrance of Baal will be removed. The second result in verse 18, there'll be the restoration of security, and the land no longer will be hurt by the wild animals or be damaged by war. The third result in verses 19 and 20 is the new betrothal. And the word betrothal is used three different times here, each one emphasizing a different facet of the new betrothal. The first betrothal emphasizes time. I'll betroth you unto me forever. She will never be guilty of adultery again. Second betrothal emphasizes content. I'll betroth you unto me in righteousness, justice, loving kindness, and mercies. This would be like the bride price of that day. And the third betrothal emphasizes quality. I'll even betroth you unto me in faithfulness, and you shall know Jehovah. And the last result in verses 21 through 23 will be the reversal of the names. They'll again be called Jezreel, but this time they experience Jezreel, meaning God sows. In place of God scatters, they'll be sown back into land. And they'll be called Ruchamam, meaning those that have obtained mercy, and Amim, they are my people. So we learn from chapters 1 and 2 so far is that he was asked to be a prophet, and part of his prophetic way to communicate with his people is through his own marriage. And from the day he was first told to marry the prostitute, he's already told, don't expect a happy marriage. Anticipate an unhappy marriage. Anticipate an unfaithful wife. And what your wife does to you is what Israel has done to me. Now, capital C, the second commission to Hosea in chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. And Joseph said to me, go again, love a woman, beloved of her friend. Gomer, after producing those three children for Hosea in chapter 1, left him and once again followed the life of a prostitute. But after a while, she got older and older, and now she is not only a prostitute, she's become an adulteress, and she's sold into slavery, and yet her husband loves her still. And now the prophet is commissioned to take her back and to love her still. And the application is made quickly in verse 1. God still loves Israel. God loves Israel still. even though they turned to other gods. In spite of her loving other gods, God still loves Israel. And although she still goes after cakes of raisins, again, these are symbolic symbols used that way in Song of Solomon, chapter 2, verse 5. Song of Solomon 2, verse 5. And Jeremiah 7, used for idol worshiping. And once again, Hosea obeys in verses 2 and 3. And in verse 2, at this point, his adulterated wife is being sold in the slave market. So he buys her out of the slave market for 15 pieces of silver and 1.5 homer of barley, which is also equal to 15 pieces of silver. Altogether, she's purchased for the grand value of 30 pieces of silver, not a complimentary price. That was the value price of a dead slave in Exodus chapter 21, verse 32, Exodus 21:32. But sure, she had been utterly used up. She had been sold into slavery. Her worth was equivalent to that of a dead slave. And after bringing her back to his home in verse 3, he says to her, "You will abide for me many days without two things. You will no longer play the harlot. You will no longer be guilty of adultery. And secondly, you will not have any conjugal rights for a while. And I'll be the same way towards you." And under capital D, he concludes with the application to the wife of Jehovah, verses 4 and 5, because of Israel also, the wife of Jehovah, there'll be many days of deprivation. The children of Israel shall abide many days without king and prince, meaning with no civil authority. And they lost their king after Babylon, and they will lose their princes after Rome. Without sacrifice and ephod, they won't even have the experience of true worship. Without sacrifice means there'll be no temple. Without ephod means they'll have no priesthood. They won't even be able to exercise true worship in accordance with the Mosaic law. That will certainly be the case in captivity. But also he says, without pillar and teraphim, these are two elements of false worship, idolatrous worship. Without pillar means they won't be worshiping temple gods. Without teraphim, they won't be worshiping any household gods either. So it pictures a long period of history for the Jewish people. No civil authority, no true worship, but no idolatry either. And this has been true of Israel, particularly from AD 70 to the present day. However, verse 5 promises a final restoration. Notice the word afterward. After the period of many days, in the latter days, the children of Israel shall return and shall seek Jehovah their God. They'll find them through the Messiah and David their king, and David will be their co-regent in the Messianic kingdom. And this will come with fear and back to the Lord. We can summarize what Hosea says here in six basic points. First of all, they'll suffer Jezreel, kingdom destroyed, nation scattered. Jezreel, kingdom destroyed, nation scattered. Secondly, lo ruchama, without mercy. Thirdly, lo ami, not my people. But in the future, they'll be sown to Jehovah, Jezreel. They'll become God's people, ami, and obtain mercy, ruchama. The rest of his book, he'll spend more with the issue of lo ruchama, lo ami. But his last chapter will show eventually there'll be ruchama, there will be ami. So Zaire was called to the prophetic office in a very unusual manner, asking to marry a prostitute, have an unhealthy, unhappy marriage, always realizing that what is happening to him is happening to the Lord. But eventually, Israel will someday come back, and that is the future we're hoping for. We don't have to hope for it. It will happen after our blessed hope of the rapture of the church. This concludes our study for this occasion. Let me make just a few announcements to tie some things together. First of all, if anybody here has felt any leading of the Lord to make a monetary commitment to ministry, simply fill out this slip and give your name and address and tear it off. you can leave it, eat in the offering plate as it comes around. Just leave the literature table on the side. And again, if you wish to support the ministry, let us know the amount, and we'll let you know by letter when to begin mailing it in. But again, that's the only time you hear from us about this. We simply do not send out reminders to people. We feel this is strictly between you and the Lord. If God does supply the amount you mail in, if not, you won't. Also, keep in mind, we're happy to send you our material free of charge. We do not require people to give to be on a mail list. So if you want to be on a mail list, simply fill this out and turn it in. In about 4 to 6 weeks, we'll send you some more information about the ministry, and we will be sending you a copy of our catalog. The catalog is this yellow sheet. It lists all the other studies you can do from a Jewish perspective. Also sent you a copy of my personal testimony, how I became a believer years ago in Brooklyn, New York. After that, every 3 months, we'll send you a newsletter. It is now 12 pages. It's been put together in a new format. It looks like this now. And the other 8 pages will be news of our branches and reports of Jewish people coming to faith. You'll find articles on Jewish customs and traditions and beliefs. But inside 4 pages will be a written out Bible study. This one is how the wise men knew about the birth of the king. And you can separate the inside from the rest and use it as God might give you to use it. And again, it's all free of charge. You want to receive it, simply fill out this slip before you leave and turn it in. Also, if you'd like to receive a receipt for the amount you've been given this week or be given tonight, mark the amount in the upper left-hand corner where it says I'm closing so much in place. Offering, we'd be happy to send you a number receipt for your tax records. And again, we'll check out the check you made out to our ministries. Also, if you intend to sign up for any of the books in the side table or the tapes and so on, please do that tonight. And I'll be sending the orders in to the office sometime tomorrow, and I'll be able to begin to fill it in fairly quickly. And again, we are going to be doing a study tour of Israel. There'll be a 3-week tour, and I do have the information sheets for this year's tour. It begins on June 16th. And if you like to think you might want to attend, see me afterwards for these sheets, and this will give you all the details. I think we have about 3 people interested, and if all 3 people come, we may have a sizable Hawaiian, Berean accommodations. We'll even give you your own van if you like, but see how that works. But if you haven't had these sheets, you want them, please see me afterwards. All right, we'll go ahead and have our free will offering. After the offering, we'll have a closing song, and if you need to leave, that'll be the time to slip out. But if you want to stay, we'll have a question and answer session right after the last song. And if you want to stay longer, we'll then have our final luau in the back.